from her more.
Everybody's so tall up here. There's a stand. Oh, hi, my name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. So, I have no plans whatsoever up here. It's like I'm going to let it be divinely inspired and let the ego take the back seat. Hopefully. And, wow, that's a big meeting. And, hi, Ann. let's see what it was like. however that goes. That's going to be prepare me for tomorrow night. I'm going to do stand up at the comedy club tomorrow, so I better get it good. Anyway, welcome to all the newcomers. Congratulations, token takers. That's awesome. And I just got 7 years last month. And any newcomers that are in here, I beg of you, please do it the way it's suggested, because I didn't. I'm just on my fourth step right now. I've been around the rooms for about 14 years, and I haven't completely read the book. I have never completely done the steps, and it's been, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and it's been very painful, you know. So if I had it to do over again, which I do not want to do, and I have done that. Anybody coming in here for the first time, please do it the way it's suggested. It is that way for a reason, just like they say when you jump out of an airplane with a parachute, pull the ripcord. It's that way. It's suggested that way for a reason. I had 2 months shy of 5 years, and I took a sip of margarita. I thought, well, I'm not really an alcoholic. It's, you know, things were going better in my life. I thought I had control of things, and things were going better. And I asked a friend of mine, well, do I really have to throw away 5 years? She said, well, you know what to do. It's like, okay, well, all you suckers are going to be taking your hats off to me. And I did some controlled drinking. that's right. And that didn't last very long. It was very controlled, and it was really hard to control it. And I was like, forget this, man. I'm going to drink how I want to drink. And went to the bar a couple times, opened up a tab. That was a bad idea. And, you know, and towards the end of that, you know, it got to the point where I stopped breathing, you know, because alcohol is a depressant in your system, and I woke up gasping for breath. And that's insane. Insanity. And, you know, so those questions got answered. Those questions that I had got answered. I had to do it again just to make sure that alcohol was the common denominator. You know, make sure I wasn't allergic to cherry tomatoes or something like that. You know, so I did that again, and I drank again, tried some controlled drinking, and, you know, and this time I woke up, you know, just literally, you know, not breathing. I woke up gasping for air, and my son was home at that time, and he's freaking out. What do I do? Call 911. And I'm just, you know, and that's insane. I'd like to say that was the last time I drank, but it wasn't. You know, but thank God that relapse gave me the answers to the questions that I had, you know, because the insanity of trying to achieve some kind of control, because I love to drink. I still love to drink. I go to karaoke. I do all this stuff now, and I, you know what, it's okay, but I still get the smell of tequila, and I get that little Pavlov's response. My cheeks still water. Doesn't mean I want to drink it. I like breathing a lot more than I like drinking. Thank God. You know, but the first 5 years, I came prepared. Everybody knows I'm a crier. But I got into AA because my son was molested. In the first 5 years, I was trying to work on that instead of my drinking. I thought, you know what, I need to take care of this because that's a more important issue than my drinking. And, you know, going to Children's Hospital and that counseling and everything. You know, and he stabilized a little bit, and I thought, okay, you know, everything's okay now. You know, and the problems from that just go on and on and on. And it was just, you know, just over a year ago that I finally let him go. And some friends in here know how long I've struggled with that. He was in an accident when he was 16, or not even close to 16. You know, he stole my car for the second time. Ran into a house. I got sued for $5 million. You know, and I was still trying to maintain a job, you know, working at Scripps in La Jolla. And I just couldn't do it. I've been on disability since then. I'm dually diagnosed. Nobody's ever diagnosed me. That's why I self-medicated with my own medication. You know, but it's still okay. Everything's okay. You know, and because of that, he went into a group home, and it's taken a really, really long time for me to figure out that I cannot do anything for him, a really long time, because our lives are so parallel. And once I finally let go, it's like, get on it, Leanne, work for yourself, you know, do the steps. That's why I cannot stress enough. Any newcomer in here, do it the way it's suggested. And I am just so envious, absolutely envious. Please do it the way it's suggested, because I could just kick myself over and over again. Because doing it now, it's so odd trying to go over this stuff now that, you know, 7 years into it or 14 years into it, you know, stuff that, you know, I'm going over that, you know, because I haven't used crystal or smoke pot in, you know, 14 years and, you know, drank in 7, and it's just really odd to go over some of those things, you know, after having some abstinence. I was supposed to look at the clock, and whoever is helping me watch, audience, do the wave when it's like, when I got 3 minutes left to help me watch the clock. You know, but everything happens for a reason. God doesn't give you anything you can't handle. You know, because I was devastated when all that happened to my son. And I've been on disability for a while. You know, last year at this time, I couldn't even buy milk for myself. You know, I'd just been plugging along and doing what little I can. You know, I was having rice and pears for dinner for the longest time. And last year, I started a business of my own. It just kind of fell on my lap. My best friend of 20 years moved to Mississippi, and she gave me her hedger and her lawnmower. So I started my own landscaping business. It's called Two Ladies and a Hoe. whatever works. Yeah. It's a real serious. Is that 2 minutes? Okay. Oh, okay. You know, it's a real serious business, you know, but it's, you know, I've been in the medical field for 20 years, and I just, I'm making better money doing this, and I can show up if and when I want to, and life is okay, and my son is an addict and an alcoholic, and he's on his own path, and it's, and life is good. AA has saved my butt, and I really know what people mean when they say they're a grateful recovering alcoholic. It's like, what the hell are you grateful for? I'm grateful that I have lessons to live by, and I'm envious of any newcomer that is in here that grabs hold of a sponsor that they trust and gets them to walk them through these steps. It does not have to be done 100%, but it has to be done. Because I have tried it every other way, and it's been very painful. I am still sober, but it's been an excruciating process. Please do it the way it's suggested. Thank you for letting me share.
To show your respect for the meeting, please remain seated for the following announcements. There is an H&I green can on the literature table for donations to purchase literature for incarcerated or hospitalized alcoholics. Our group institution representative is Kelly, and that's me. Hi, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm your GIRD, which is a group institutional representative GIRD. Anyway, the green can, 100% of the money that you guys put in the green can goes to buy literature for incarcerated individuals, hospitals, people in hospitals, institutions that can't get out to get meetings. So panels, bring the literature in there. Yes. Bring the literature in there and give it away free. So as a matter of fact, tomorrow's the H&I meeting at 5150 Kearney Mesa Road. So I'll be there to turn in the money in the green can, and thanks for letting me be of service. And we have literature available in the back. The hardcover books and pamphlets are for sale at our cost. And I would like to direct your attention to Bob, who will take care of the literature purchase. Hi, Bob.
Please see me after the meeting. Thank you.
So that our speaker may start on time, please return to your seats when you hear the bell ring. And if you would like to continue talking, please do so far, far away from the meeting. We will now have a short coffee and cake break. Seat next to you, please raise your hand. That's what it says. It says I have to ask that. Okay. To those now in its fold, Alcoholics Anonymous has made the difference between misery and sobriety, and often the difference between life and death. AA can mean just as much to the uncounted alcoholics not yet reached. Therefore, no society of men and women ever have had a more urgent need for continuous effectiveness and permanent unity. We alcoholics see that we must work together and hang together, else most of us will finally die alone. Tonight, I have asked Daniel to read the 12 traditions. Where am I? All right, and now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Paul G. from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Foothills Group in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I'm overjoyed to be here. I want to thank the people that trapped me. And I hope, it's funny, I was at a speaker meeting in Albuquerque just last week. I'm only up here visiting for this week. And they asked somebody to speak, and the person got up and said, I've just been told that I was the speaker and asked to fill in for the speaker who didn't show up, and I don't really know what I'm going to say tonight. Mm-hmm. And someone from the back, tell us your story. So, That's what you're going to get from me. You know what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I do have to preface that by making a comment that I am one of those very, very, very grateful alcoholics. You know, this is the best my life has ever been, and you're going to hear some stuff here that will, I think, prove not only that it's I don't drink anymore and I'm a different person than I used to be, but how certain things happened in my life just recently and how I'm handling them. And it's all thanks to you, and you'll understand when I say you a little bit later when I get into this thing. I just noticed, you know, I wrote just a couple of crib notes. Steve, one of my sponsees, says, don't forget to tell them about this. Okay. So I got these little crib notes here, but at the very top of the page, it's got the wrong name. It's got Bob's name on here, you know. So Bob, listen up. This is your story. Anyway, I was raised in a very dogmatic, Catholic, and alcoholic family. I come from a family, and it pervades my life today, although all the members of that family are dead except for me. But it pervades my life today where there was absolutely no affiliation, association, love, or caring between the four people that lived in this apartment house in the Bronx. You know, and I grew up that way. I swore it would be different when I got to be a father, when I got to be a husband, etc. And it was absolutely no different whatsoever. And that's continued even into my life right now. I have made amends to my kids on this, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But the bottom line is, when I hear people talking about the close family relationships and stuff like that, I'm very happy for them. But in many ways, I don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about. You know, and that's just that's part of my story, etc. Anyway, and once again, I have to make a comment, which I always do when I'm talking, and that's the fact that I have absolutely nothing against organized religion. My sponsor is a member of that. A lot of my sponsees are members. I also sponsor an atheist and an agnostic down in Albuquerque, and that's interesting. But the bottom line is, you know, I love that meeting between Ebby and Bill W. Huh? Why don't you get a higher power that you can do business with? And I'll describe a little of that because it was a very important part of my recovery and my story now. But anyway, as I said, I was raised in a family where alcoholism was I was going to say the number one topic, and that's not true because it wasn't talked about. Okay, it was number one issue. How's that? It was the number one issue in our home, but we certainly didn't talk about it. I was born up in upstate New York to a French-Canadian family. We lived in a little French-Canadian enclave, and I learned French. At the age of four, we moved down to New York City, to the Bronx. All I spoke at that time was French. And for those of you who don't know that much about the Bronx, French is not the native language of the Bronx. He says it's okay. So anyway... and that started sort of, I'll give you a little incident and tie it in later on to the third step. I'm a four-year-old, I'm in the Bronx, I speak French only. There's a higher power down there, he's a six-year-old. His name is Peter Sampson, and six-year-olds are generally higher powers to four-year-olds. And Peter Sampson's very upset that I cannot speak English. He chases me down in the afternoon in front of our apartment house, throws me on the ground, shakes me, and says, "Speak English, speak English. Je ne peux pas. You know, I can't, you know. I can't do something I can't do, you know." So that goes on for a while. And at that time, Peter's my higher power. There's no question about it. But about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, my 11-year-old brother comes home. So I go upstairs to apartment 9J, knock on the door, because I'm too young to have a key. And Bob comes and, "Oh, Peter Sampson's beating me up again." Bob goes down, finds Peter Sampson, says, "Leave my kid brother alone." Do you know that for the rest of the afternoon, Peter Sampson doesn't bother me? And I think that's a lot of what we do in our third step, huh? I've got a higher power already, and I know that, and that's alcoholism. There is no doubt in my mind that my alcoholism is a higher power of mine, and you'll hear some of that stuff in a few minutes. And I get up every morning, and I formed this habit. I've got 22 and a half years of recovery, and I formed this habit on my third birthday when a friend of mine at that time gave me an AA medallion. And I formed the habit of putting it on, okay, But at nighttime, I take it off because I'm afraid of choking on it or breaking it or some reason. I don't know. But I got in this habit of taking it off at nighttime. In the morning, I'm just the type of guy that needs a gimmick. So I put my medallion back on, and I turn my life and will over to the care of my higher power. I do my third-step prayer. I do my seventh-step prayer. And as you'll find here a little bit later on, from there on, I just don't have any fears, any worries. You know, I don't think there's, I don't know of anything that's more powerful than my higher power. I can't tell you what it is, but I don't believe there's anything more powerful than it. And if I'm tethered into the hands of my higher power, what the hell have I got to worry about? You know, so that's a little thing that started, but it's an issue again of the higher power thing, which my big brother was, fortunately, to Peter Samson, which my higher power is, fortunately, to my alcoholism. You know, and that's the way it works. It works very nicely that way. First drink. Always got to talk about first drink. As I said, alcohol was a big issue. My dad was an alcoholic. He was the worst kind. According to Father Martin and a lot of the other crowd, he was a periodic. He would go months without drinking, proving to himself what? That he doesn't have a drinking problem. And then on a Thursday night, because he got paid on Thursdays, New York Subway's really on time. They're really, really good. And if he wasn't in our house, and we lived one block away from the subway, if he wasn't in the house by about 7:15 on Thursday, we knew he was at the Greenleaf Bar drinking the payaway. And the next time we would see him would be Sunday morning. He'd come home, take a shower, clean up, go to sleep. And next morning he'd get up and go to work as if absolutely nothing in the world had happened. And my mom, the enabler, would get on the phone on Friday morning, call the boss and say, you know, Ernest won't be in today. We're having trouble with our car. The fan belt's broke, or the battery's dead, or this or that. I said before, we live in the Bronx. Most people in the Bronx don't own cars. We didn't. But that was the excuse, you know, all the time, you know, that, oh yeah, the car's real. And I can't help but feel that the boss knew that we didn't have a car, you know, but that's just the way that was. But anyway, she'd make the excuses, and that's who Dad was. Anyway, my mom kept a bottle of blended whiskey. My mom drank cream sherry once in a long while. But she kept a bottle of blended whiskey in the house. Now, I would presume that that was just in case somebody stopped by to visit. We were the typical alcoholic family, right? No one ever stopped by and visited us. I can't recall anybody ever coming to that house. Anyway, she had this bottle of blended whiskey. And I don't know why, but one day, I was about 13 or 14, and I found the bottle in a closet behind some towels. See, she's laughing because she's saying, now why was he looking behind a bunch of towels? Beats me, I don't know, but I found the bottle there anyway. And I remember looking at that thing and remembering that, you know, this is the thing that's causing all the trouble, all the problems and everything in the world in our house. This is what's controlling our house and also my grandparents' house still in upstate New York. And I says, well, you know, let's see what it's, you know, what's it? And I took that smell, and, you know, it's terrible, 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 you know. Oh, jeez, that's rotten stuff, you know. Must be something. It must taste good, even though it's like Limburger cheese. Huh? It smells bad, tastes good. Okay. So I unscrewed the top, and, of course, at my age, all we got is Pepsi and Coke bottles around, and you take that, and you take a slug out of it, right? So I unscrewed this blended whiskey and took a slug of this blended whiskey, and... you know, the teeth melted, the tongue was on fire, the smoke's coming out, the hair is falling off the head, and I'm, good God, this is terrible, you know, and I put the thing down, put it back, put the towels, and go back and listen to the Brooklyn Dodgers, New York Giants, a little dating here, but you know, by the time I got to the living room, as Bill says, it had arrived. You know, it was down here. And all of a sudden I lost weight, I gained height, I became muscular. Hell of a 13-year-old kid, you know. Everything was going to be okay. And you know what I did immediately after that, don't you? I went right back to the closet, got that booze, and started drinking. The only reason I stopped drinking that particular 13- or 14-year-old day was I figured my mom had probably marked that bottle somehow for, you know, to keep him out of it and so that. And I'm getting worried about it, so I'm putting water in it. you know, eventually this blended whiskey was starting to look like cream soda, you know, and so I stopped at that time, and I never heard anything about it. But the bottom line of that is that's my first drink, and on that day I drank alcoholically. I did not ever cross any line into alcoholic type drinking. I drank that way from that, and every time I had an opportunity to drink from age 13 to age 46, I drank all I could every time I could. So I drank alcoholically all those years. The only thing that probably saved me from complete disaster from my alcoholism was the fact that I ended up having a life pattern that sort of constrained my drinking. My mom, being the good old enabler of an alcoholic, every time in high school I went out for a date or did something, etc., when I came back in, it was, "Oh, Paul, is that you?" And I felt like saying, "No, it's an armed robber, you know. Who the hell else is coming home here at this time?" So anyway, she said, "Come and give me a kiss." I don't think that my mom loved me, I'm sure of this, but I don't think that had anything to do with this kiss. I was like, "If you've been drinking, you know," and stuff like that. So that sort of kept the wraps on me. I was lucky enough to go to the United States Naval Academy after high school. And in Maryland in those days, at the Naval Academy, there was a state law that restricted midshipmen from drinking within 7 miles of the academy. The only time you got away from the Naval Academy in those days was on your summer vacation, your one-month summer vacation, the Christmas vacation, your summer cruises, and away football games. You know, the Army game is played in Philadelphia, and Notre Dame we played in Baltimore, and Duke we played down in Washington. I remember during my 4 years going to a lot of football games. I sure don't remember coming home from many of them, though. I'll tell you, I was a blackout drinker from day one. That's the bottom line of this thing. So, anyhow, I went into the United States. I graduated from the Academy, went in the Navy, and you know, the United States Navy, for those of you who don't know this, is the only Navy in the world that does not have alcohol aboard ships. I think that saved my life. I really honestly think that saved my life. But, you know, it was a case of, okay, I'm not drinking at sea because I'm not supposed to and I'm not going to, et cetera, et cetera. But is that land over there? You know, man, the minute you put me ashore, it was all over but the pain and the agony of it. So that's about that. I had a very unusual naval career, sort of like I'm what they call a surface warfare officer. I drive ships. The issue was that I didn't get aboard ship for a long period of time because of the Vietnam War. But I moved one step ahead here. Anyway, after 4 years in destroyer duty, I got on shore duty and went to MIT. Now you think, hey, this guy's really smart. He went to MIT. I was an ROTC instructor at MIT teaching Navy stuff. And so I qualified from the Navy stuff, not from the smarts of MIT. But anyway, I'm up there, and I'm on shore duty now. And I'm trying for the first time to become a husband and a father. The thing I accuse that guy of never having been. He wasn't a good father. He wasn't a good husband. When I grow up, when I have kids, when I have a wife, man, the kids are going to see that I love them. The kids are going to see that I love my wife. It's going to be just the happiest, joyous, loving family in the world. And as I mentioned here earlier, I don't just come from that, and I never had that in my life. So I'm up there at MIT on shore duty for a year, and I'm just about ready to kill myself. Because I know I'm turning into the worst father than he was, the worst husband than he was, and it's like a lot of shame, a lot of guilt coming about this. And fortunately, and it's a funny way to use this for this next event, fortunately there was an event back in Southeast Asia called the Tonkin Gulf, where some American ships were supposedly, or maybe even really, shot at by North Vietnamese patrol boats. And you know, here I am on shore duty and wondering how the hell am I going to get out of this shore duty, and oh, my country's at war. Well, that solves that problem right there. I pick up the phone and call down, volunteered, and a month later I'm on my way to Vietnam. I had a very unusual naval job in Vietnam. I was an advisor to the Vietnamese river forces, basically, and we lived in these little river bases and stuff. It wasn't anything like a United States naval officer supposed to be doing. Marine? Yeah. Naval officer? No. And anyway, I had some success at that tour. I got to tell you here, I end up with two full tours in Vietnam, actually in Vietnam, in a combat time situation. And I don't think I drew a sober breath in the 2 years I was in Vietnam. In this one case here, I'd go out to the field with two enlisted guys, and we'd advise a Vietnamese outfit of about 100. And on the way out to the place, I would always have a couple bottles of bourbon with me, my favorite. And if we were out there for more 4 or 5 days or so, two bottles of bourbon just don't make it that long. And so we'd always make up a request. We had no communications with Americans. I had to talk to my Vietnamese counterpart, and he talked to the Vietnamese in Da Nang, and the Vietnamese in Da Nang talked to the Americans in Da Nang, and et cetera. So we'd send down the message, more ammunition, more this, more that, more boned chicken to mix with our two-a-day rice dinners, et cetera. And invariably, I'd stick in there, you know, in two bottles of bourbon. Well, I could always tell if I was getting it or not. I mean, sometimes they got sidetracked, you know. So when some wise guy in the chain of command figured they shouldn't be sending bourbon out to me in the field. But I could always tell if I was getting it or not, because an Army helicopter would arrive, start circling overhead, and they didn't like our bases. Our bases were not friendly places. And they come down, and if they hovered off about 3 or 4 feet and threw bags out of stuff like that, that was ammunition, that was canned chicken, canned tuna fish, et cetera, and stuff like that, and then fly off, I knew I hadn't gotten my stuff. But after they had done all of this sort of stuff, as bad as they just came down and touched for a second, the crew chief got out and put a couple of bags, put something real casually down on the ground and said, "Ah, bourbon. You guys go get the ammunition. I got my bourbon, you know?" And so it's just, but anyway, the bottom line of all that is probably under the influence of alcohol, I did some notable things. And anyway, I we don't have time. But anyway, a request came out from the Naval Academy for an academy graduate who's been in the field and in combat and getting close to the end of his tour to go back to the Naval Academy to sort of talk. This is 1965. Most people don't even know where Vietnam is yet, okay? So I get selected to go back to Naval Academy to be the role model for the midshipmen and tell war stories. Anyway, when I got back there was a big parade, there were some newspaper articles, and the Washington Post, Baltimore Sun, and all that sort of stuff. Believe me, whatever I did was nothing compared to what happens later, but I'm the only guy back in the, you know, the news box, and I'm something here. So, yeah. So anyway, the Academy got a whole bunch of requests for me to go speak, and started a year and a half of a very interesting life. I'd get called from Kiwanis Group in Baltimore, Maryland. They say, "Can you come out on such and such a day?" Sure. And I'd go down there, and the first time I went, they said, "Can you come a little early? We'll take you out to dinner." Incidentally, Bob, thank you much for the dinner tonight. Okay. And so I go out, and the guy said, "Okay, you want a drink before dinner?" The bad part about that question is they meant exactly that. You want a drink before dinner, you know, and man alive, you know, I got to stop doing this stuff, you know, I learned that, and I thought, well, at least with dinner, they'll ask if I want some wine. Nope. So after the presentation, yeah, hurrah, hurrah, a couple guys said, "You want to come out with us? We're going to go out and get a drink." And I missed the word again. And sure enough, they went out and we had a drink. Out of the 30 or 40 times that I did this type of thing, last time I went to dinner before, last time I went out afterwards with them. But the interesting part was I would then go out and start drinking. Seriously. And the next, I drink and drink, and I'm in Baltimore. The next thing I know, I come to in the car, I'm sitting in the driver's seat, so I know how I've been moving from place to place. But I look around, and there's a lot of statues. And Baltimore doesn't have a lot of statues. Washington, D.C. has a lot of statues. Yeah. And for the next year and a half, that was my living pattern. I went and spoke somewhere, went and drank afterwards, and in a blackout drove from Philadelphia to Wilmington or to Annapolis to this or that and stuff like that. Well, anyway, after a period of time, I'm starting to get a little concerned about my drinking and driving and et cetera. And one night I'm coming home from the academy drunk, and we live in a little rural area of Maryland. And as I got to this little rural road of driving up here, I'm driving along, you know, and all of a sudden I see this rabbit in front of my car. And I turned the wheel and I drove down that little shoulder and up a little bit side of the hill, you know, and stuff like that. And I look in the rearview mirror and I see this bleep, 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 Maryland State Police. And I said, oops, this is going to be interesting. A little combat experience might be needed here. So anyway, I get out of the car and I'm getting ready to give him a fast story about what's going on, what isn't going on, and blah, 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 blah. And he, before I'm able to say anything, he says, you must love animals. And I said, you saw that rabbit? And he said, yeah, just the cutest little bunny rabbit about this. And said, you know, I'm thinking, man, that's not the rabbit I saw. Rabbit I saw was about this big and pink in color. And so anyway, he says, come on, get in the car. I'll call a tow and they'll tow you out and we'll get you on your way home. You're a lieutenant, you know. And I was, oh, yeah, fine, fine, fine. And I came in, Jesus, it's a cold day. I'm drunk as a skunk. And I'll bet you the inside of that patrol car is hot. And I have a habit of throwing up when I get real, real drunk and sick. And, you know, I just don't think that that's the idea that a cop really wants to have happen, you know. And so I said, officer, get in there, try to back this car up, and I'll push it up, you know, down the little hill and up the little ravine. It's amazing what we can do, isn't it, when we have those type of requirements placed on us, you know. Push it up there. He said, holy Moses, you know. So I get home, tell my wife what's going on here. And this time I've got a real secret, huh? I mean, a real excuse. And she looks at me and says, boy, you come up with some doozers, you know. The next morning I get in the car to go back to work, and I look over here, and there's a flashlight over there, and it says, Maryland State Police. So like any righteous alcoholic, I go running in there, showing the flashlight, you know, and about a week later, I'm driving along, and I realize I've come to looking at a sign that says, Interstate 95 North Baltimore Tunnel, next, and I go, well, I don't want to go there. I live south of Baltimore, and here I'm in the interstate, you know, and I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do? Well, I guess I'll have to go all the way through, turn around, well, I hope I make that. And I saw a little sign over here that said, U-turn, official car only. Well, I'm driving a black car. And I've got a uniform on, so that's about as official as you really want to get, isn't it? So I start making a U-turn on Interstate 95, and I start through this thing, and I see the steel bar. And I say to myself, this is going to be a problem. That bar hit the hood, flattened the hood, hit the front of the windshield, bent the windshield forward, put a warm lap of glass in my lap, you know, and ended about that far away. And I thought, oh my, you know, we sober up real fast when those things happen, okay? We just like that, I was sober. Guys in the tower had seen it, came down, got me, called my wife, she came, got me, and away we went. That. Well, anyway, I'm starting to get, and this is the one, I'm starting to get a little concerned about all this stuff, you know, I'm really running out of luck, maybe. So this one day, I'm on Maryland State 50. And this is a two-lane road this way, two-lane road this way, straight as can be, with a great big medium, grass medium between. And I'm driving along, and I'm thinking about all this drunken driving I'm doing, coming to in different cities, driving up the hill, driving, making a U-turn. And I said, man, alive, I got to, you know, maybe I got to tone this down a little bit, you know. And I'm driving along, and I say, well, you know, maybe I'm overreacting to all these problems. Because here I am in the high-speed lane of Maryland State Route 50, and I'm centerlined right on that, right on this lane. I'm not swerving in any direction. I must be overreacting a little bit to my problems with drinking. And as I'm thinking about this, I hear a. And I look over here at the window. There seems to be a person there. I look over again, and his mouth is moving. And I said, well, I don't have to take this insult from anybody. I'm going to speed off and leave him, you know. He's going pretty fast to start with, but I bet you can't keep up with me. So I push my foot down on the accelerator and realize my foot's all the way down on the accelerator already. And I look at the speedometer, and the speedometer's on zero. I look at the fuel gauge is on empty. I had basically run out of gas in a high-speed lane and didn't even know it. And this guy said, get this goddamn car off the road, you idiot! You know? So, I hope that by telling you a few of those things, I have qualified as an alcoholic. That was the important part, you know? What it was like, I want to make sure that you don't think I'm up here BSing or anything about what's happening from that. Okay, anyway, a lot of other stuff happens afterwards. It's a disaster. And it finally gets to the point where in 1977, I get called in. I'm on an admiral staff, and I get called in by the admiral, and the admiral says, you know, you're a damn good naval officer. I wonder how good you would have been if you'd been sober some of the time. Now, I know probably what's coming after this is not good news for me. You know? 1977, I'm a 59 graduate of the academy. That means I've got 18 and a half years in. That's not enough to retire. Uh-oh. And he says, I've done some homework for you. I think he called Jerry Bunn. He says, I've done some homework for you, and I found out where there's a meeting tonight, and you're going to go to an AA meeting tonight, and you're going to keep going to those AA meetings tonight. And if you ever have another drink between now and your 20th year when you're eligible to retire, I'll throw your ass out of the Navy that day. And I looked at these three stars up here, and I said, you know, you might be able to do that. A year and a half without drinking, you know, this is not Paul. You know, no, that I'm thinking about a pension too for the rest of my life, huh? So I went to the meeting. I heard two things at that meeting. I heard 90 meetings in 90 days, and I heard take what you want and leave the rest. You have to be very careful when these two phrases are used to newcomers. You should have an old timer explain what they're trying to say by this, huh? Because what I heard was 90 meetings, 90 days. I'm a compliant guy. I follow orders. I can go to 90 meetings, 90 days. So, and I did. The next thing I heard was take what you want and leave the rest. And I sat in the back of the room and I think I'll take that bond. Some redhead's okay, but I'm gonna have to leave her and take her. You know, that's where my mindset was. You know, I was. Gotta bear him something, and I forgot to tell you this. And my dad, my three uncles were real alcoholics. All of them went to AA for years and years and years. I have one uncle that went to a New York State, upstate in Glens Falls, New York, a meeting in 1940s, the mid-40s. He died in the mid-80s still drinking. My dad did the same thing. When someone would put the heat on my dad, he'd go to AA for a while. And then he'd go out and drink again. My other two uncles, the same thing. What I knew growing up is AA does not work. And when the heat is real bad, you go to AA until the heat gets off. And once the heat is off, you're off. And that's what basically the next 8 years of my life are like. I went to hundreds and hundreds of meetings. I've got in here, you guys will all recognize this. I do this in Albuquerque at some place and say, what's that? You know, American Airlines? No, that's a 90-day token, huh, from San Diego. That's number 7. I was told at one point you're not supposed to make a necklace out of those, Paul. You're supposed to get one and keep moving. And I said, no, I heard it. 90 meetings, 90 days. I went to 90 meetings. I had 90 days. I got this, and I made a speech about how great you guys are to take care of me and blah, 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 blah. And that was it, right? Yeah. So you got to be very careful and explain what you mean. You know, 90 means 90 days, get you situated, comfort, and stuff like that. Get a sponsor in the meantime. Start working the steps, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and I still have trouble with take what you want and leave the rest. I don't think I'm qualified to make that decision. Okay? I listen to everything going on and hopefully use what I can out of it. But anyway, 1977, that started that. And I went to 90 meetings, 90 days, got my first token, made a speech, and everybody said, wonderful, this is fantastic. I never, ever made it to 100 days. You know, I did my 90 meetings, 90 days, got my token, made my speech, and just never made it to 100 days. The only time in that 8-year time frame from 1977 to my sobriety date, January 14th, 85, that I have more sobriety than less than 100 days, is one time for 3 years. I said to myself, Paul, you've got a drinking problem. You can handle it. You're a big, well-educated man. You're a successful naval officer. You just make up your mind you're through drinking, and I bet you it'll happen. I also, and nothing once again against the religious aspects, but I also went back to the religion. My childhood became very, very Catholic. Kicked my racquetball up from 1 hour to 2 hours a day. I was going to extreme lengths to try to stay away from drinking. And I did for over 3 years. And the funny thing happened, though, after 3 years of lots of religious stuff, lots of racquetball, lots of work, etc., one night in a Safeway, I got attacked by a quart of Budweiser beer. And, you know, that's... And it was funny because it was after I had finished my racquetball and I went to the same Safeway store night after night after night. And I got to the store and this kid was checking me out, and he checked me out a lot of times, and I always had a couple pieces of fruit, you know, an apple and an orange or something along that line. And I had this apple and orange, and over here a little bit away, I had this quart of Budweiser. And it's funny how our higher power works and gives you a few chances once in a while. Mark says, good game tonight? Yeah, great game tonight. And he says, and there's no one behind me. He says, is that yours? The quart of Budweiser. And I said, yeah, it's mine. You know, what the hell is this little kid trying to do to me? You know, I'm a grown man, an adult, and all that sort of stuff. And he's sort of, you know, insinuating that I shouldn't be having this beer. What the hell is this little kid supposed to have? So I took that beer, and I set up the game plan, right? I'll have beer on weekday nights when I'm at work up here in Long Beach. And when I go to San Diego, where my family was, I'll have a little bit of bourbon with it, too, because that's my favorite drink. And I can do that during the course of the weekend, and on Sunday I'll have just a couple beers and come back up to London. Well, of course, Thursday night I'm now buying a six-pack of beer and a pint of bourbon, you know, and it just the plan did not work very well at all. So anyway, during that time frame, I also got sent to the Navy's alcohol rehab program at 32nd Street, and we had a funny thing happening there. This was for enlisted guys. It was 120 beds there for enlisted guys. The officers were sent up to Long Beach, so the officer rehab. Someone knew something about my pride and ego, because I was sent to the enlisted program. Four stripes, all that sort of stuff. Captain of the Navy, and I'm in there. And the CO, or the officer in charge of that particular unit at that time, was a commander. Oops, excuse me. Well, one rank below me. I understand that when I was leaving, Jerry looked over at me this one time and he says, you have no idea how happy I am that you're leaving. You have been a thorn in my side, you know. After all, he's just a commander and I'm a captain. I'm gonna tell him how to run his organization. I'm the client there, but I'm gonna tell him how to run his organization, you know. But once again, I got another 90-day token and did not get to 100. I went back out drinking after that, and in and out, in and out, in and out. That's one of my favorite sayings. I've gotten sober thousands of times. I've gotten into recovery once. And what I heard earlier told me why I did. Finally, in 1985, I'm desperate. I can't... our book says, huh? We can't picture life drinking, and we can't picture life without drinking. Well, I'm a mathematician, huh? There's a common denominator there, and it's called life. So I think I ought to get out of life, and my problems will be much better. And so I started a series of four suicide attempts. Now, bear in mind, this is the picture people are looking when they see me. They see a guy who owns a beautiful home in La Mesa, looking at Mount Helix. On Sunday mornings, we're in our Mercedes, the wife is here, and the three kids are here, we're going to Mass and Communion at Santa Sophia Church. I'm the commanding officer of a ship, you know, I've got tons of stuff up here, you know, and that's what people are seeing. But that's not me, is it? Because after Sunday Mass and Communion, I make some excuse to get out of the house, and I go down El Cajon Boulevard looking for a prostitute. Oh my God, it sounds like a little different guy here, you know? Yeah, and I was one guy on the outside and a completely different individual on the inside. And I'm afraid you're going to find out. So I got to get out of this before you do. My suicide attempts were the road from 67 that goes up towards Ramona, and then there's the cutoff, I think it's Poway Road, that drops down in the Poway. Well, I don't know if it does now, but it didn't have any guardrails in those days, and I figured, hey, a car accident, that's the way to go, you know. He's working so hard he fell asleep at the wheel, you know. On those days, I did not drink. On the four Sundays that I drove that hill, they weren't consecutive, they were about a month and a half. But on those 4 times, I did not drink because I didn't want alcohol to be part of my suicide. I was afraid it might screw up the one thing I could do right for the family, insurance. You know? But when I got down to the bottom of Poway Road the 4th time, that's about the most despondent I can ever picture a human being being. I know the only way out of this puzzle is to kill myself. I have tried now 4 times and I'm unable to do it. What the hell am I going to do now? It was a Sunday afternoon. And as I said, I've been going to AA for 8 years. And I said, Sunday, well, I got 2 choices. I can go home. Oops, no, that's not a good choice. No, not a good choice. Or I can go to the Old Town Speakers meeting. And I chose to go to the Old Town Speakers meeting. And someone that Steve and I know very, very well, there had been this guy, Jonathan, and his wife, Jennifer, some of you may remember them from when they lived here. And they had helped me for all 8 years. So Jonathan was just an unbelievable saint in my life. And I came walking into the back of the meeting because I'm so ashamed and guilty of this, that. And the two of them come out of the smoke in those days, you know, up at the old Union Hall. It was just nothing but layers of smoke. Huh? They come out of the smoke, and Jennifer looks at me, and she starts crying. And Jonathan walks up and puts his arm around me, and he says, did you drive your hill today? And I said, yeah. He says, you don't have to. Stay here with us. And he brought me up to that little enclave of non-smokers up front. And all I can tell you is that when I walked into that meeting, I obviously was not in very good shape, and you know, things weren't looking real good for me. When I walked out of that meeting after them dealing with me, would be a better way of putting it, everything was different. You know, and I honestly believe an actual miracle had taken place right then. But what it was the love of the alcoholics in that room for me. Ooh. A little chicken skin, we call this in Hawaii. Okay. So I started going back to my regular meetings. And then on a Friday night, I'm an old timer now, and I only got 6 days. And on Friday night, I go to a meeting that I've been watching this old, ancient, gray-haired guy. And you know, I've been looking at them, and I said, you know, I bet you that guy would probably make a good sponsor. I'm getting the idea after only 8 years that I probably need a sponsor. You know, he'd probably make a good sponsor, you know. But you think I'm going to go up and ask him? No way, Jose. You know, that fear of rejection. What the heck does a guy that looks like he's got his act together want to do with me? So I'm still not going up and asking Bob to sponsor me. Friday night, Bob comes up to me. Thump, 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 thump. He says, I don't know if you're sick and tired of this crap, but I'm sick and tired of watching you. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor, and you're going to work the steps. And you know, that was 22 and a half years ago. And I got into recovery through a sponsor in steps. And if there's any message I ever want to put out, and Steve knows because he's one of mine, where's Doug, you here? Okay, Doug, yeah. I see my mission. I sponsor 6 guys down in Albuquerque, and I've only been down there 6 months, and I think after about 2 months I have 4 guys. But I tell them right up front, I am not your financial advisor. I am not your relations advisor. I'm not any of those things, because I'm a disaster in all those areas. But one thing I am a sober, recovering alcoholic who loves life. And I got that way because a sponsor forced me to do it, and he brought me through in a hurry. You know, it wasn't... I remember one time when I first moved back here from Hawaii 5-6 years ago, I went to a meeting up at Descanso. Some gal was getting a 4-year cake, and she was talking about the fact that she had just gotten a sponsor and was really seriously thinking about taking step one. Now, 4-year cake, you know? And those messages bother me. They really do. I think they're playing with that newcomer's life. You know, Joe and Charlie used that in one of their takes. You know, I wonder how many sponsors who do not get their sponsee moving are killing the sponsee. You know, but anyway. So I've now got 22 and a half years. I've got 11 of it in Hawaii, 9 of it here, and 2.5 in Albuquerque. Since I retired from the Navy, nothing's changed. I move. January, I looked around and said, well, I've been here for long enough. Where am I going to go? And I went back to Albuquerque. And I solid A down there. But anyway, I got to tell you, I want to wrap up here with a story of what this program means to me and what it is doing for me right now. About 2 months ago, I went in. I think I'm a fairly healthy guy. I'm 70 years old. I do have three life-threatening diseases. I've got alcoholism, type 2 diabetes, and congestive heart failure. Okay. But I do what I'm supposed to do for each of those. Huh? I exercise, I watch what I eat, I go to a lot of meetings, work my program. About 2 months ago, I walked into a doctor's office as we had some checks on this and that and et cetera, and stuff like that. And he says, the results are in and you have prostate cancer. And I said, and he goes on for about 20 minutes explaining what these results were and how they arrived at this and what this particular number meant and that number means and what probably is my situation, blah, blah, blah. And after about 20 minutes, he looked at me and he says, do you understand anything that I've said to you? I said, sure, I understand it all. He says, you know, I've given this spiel to hundreds of guys. Let them know they have cancer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He says, I've got to tell you that all of them have reacted differently than you have. My first thought was, I guess they don't have a program, you know. And he says, you know, I've had men break down in here. I've had men with their wives in here break down. I've had this, I've had that, and that. And you just sat there listening to me. And I said, well, you know, you're the doctor, and so I'm listening to this medical stuff from you. If you want to drive shifts, let me know. I'll take you out and drive some shifts somewhere, you know. And he said, but, you know, Jesus, just, so I said, yes, I understand what you're telling me. But see, because of this little gimmick routine of mine, I'm never without my higher power. I can't tell you what it is, because I'm not going to turn this human pea brain loose on defining a higher power. Because if I do that, this is, and these are all Paul, huh? But if I do that, I believe I'm going to constrain my higher power. Because my higher power is going to be something I can think of and believe in and et cetera, et cetera. And that's not my higher power. My higher power is just big time stuff. Real big time stuff. Sometimes I embarrass people by this, but I believe my higher power is so powerful and so in charge and so friendly and so loving and all those type of things. She says, I cannot, Paul, huh? I cannot conceive of my higher power allowing a devil to exist, much less a hell. What kind of higher power is that? It's not Paul's, okay? That's what I was saying about that. But anyway, that's just where I am. But I have this. And what's happened to me in the last 2 months is I've gotten closer and closer and more reliant on my understanding of that higher power than I ever was even before. You know, people come up to me and say, well, how you doing, Paul? I said, yeah, real well, excellent, you know, wonderful, you know. And, you know, they'll look at me for a few minutes. Well, I guess he doesn't understand what's going on, you know. Jesus, you know, get a grip, guy. Get a program. Get a higher power that you can trust, that you can do business with. Evie's comment again is, to me, that saved my life. When I found out that if I came in here and worked this program, that I did not have to believe the stuff that I was taught as a kid. Okay? You know, I grew up with a very damning... people used to look at my mom and say, why don't you leave that bum? You know, blah, 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 blah. And my mom's answer, just my mom's answer, no, my role here is to suffer on earth so I can be rewarded in heaven. Man, that ain't my higher power. But anyway, you know, that's... I like one of Ken D's comments where he's talking about the reading in the book, and he says that there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him Wednesday. Doesn't say that, huh? May you find him now. And that's where my belief is. I get up in the morning, put on my gimmick, do my prayers, and I set off on my day without a worry. Since then, I've made, you know, I had a whole bunch of options how to handle this. And I ended up with four that applied to me. And I read a lot of books. I talked to cancer survivors. I attended seminars. I called long-distance phone calls all over. I got a list of names, some of this. And I listened to all this information. I knew that my basic issue for me was the quality of my life. Some of the treatments for this type of cancer, the side effects are not anything I want. incontinence, drop that. I don't want that. And that's a side effect of many of them. But anyway, I looked and I finally decided this is what I'm going to do. So the other day, this is last Sunday in Albuquerque, a newcomer, a guy with a couple weeks, came up to me and he says, you know, I've heard about you and I'll keep you in my prayers. I said, thank you. And that's all, incidentally, that's all I've gotten from the AA community. Both in Albuquerque and in here, when people hear it, they'll say, I'll keep you in my prayers. The last thing I wanted to hear from anybody was, oh, poor Paul. You know, and all I have heard is, I'll keep you in my prayers. So anyway, this guy says, keep you in my prayers and stuff like that, but have you decided to what you're going to do? And I said, yeah. I made a decision. It's one of the radiation type things, a newer one. And he said, well, you had some other choices, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, what if that choice isn't the right choice? And I looked at him and I said, it is. And he looked at me and he says, well, didn't you have other choices? I said, yeah. And you made this one, yeah. But maybe one of the other ones would have been a better choice. And I said, no. The one I made the choice is the right choice. And you know, I'm sure today he's still down there scratching his head. But you know, that, and that's my belief system, huh? But that's what I've gotten out of 22 and a half years of very, very active AA participation. I go to 2 meetings a day in Albuquerque. I sponsor 6 guys. I've been there for, you know, 6 months. I answer phones at central office, something I learned from that guy. I used to do here, Connie. I answer phones at central office. I go on 12-7. I live my program. Fortunately, my higher power allows me to do that because I have, you know, I said, my higher power gave me exactly, in life gave me exactly what he thinks I can handle today. Nothing. You know, I do what I want to do, but what I want to do is I want to keep this program going. I want to have guys look at me and say thank you for helping me into recovery, you know. And my first 2 sponsees out in Hawaii were not very successful cases. One overdosed with heroin while I was gone for 2 weeks. The other guy, the armed robbery, killing somebody during the course of it, and is in jail, Halaba prison out there forever. And I went in the tank. Oh, geez, you know, if I had been here, maybe they wouldn't have done that. And this very smart AA member looked at me and he says, you know what concerns me about that statement? I said, no, what? He says, supposing they had stayed sober, would you be taking the same amount of credit that they were staying sober as you are going in the tank because they didn't? He says, Paul, your job is to offer the program to them, to bring them along as best you can. Whether they get it or not is not up to you. You're not their higher power. They want to get a higher power, and you're the intermediary as well as everybody in these programs. So anyway, I'm real, real happy to be here. I love my recovery. I love AA. Why? Because on that day back there in January 14th of 85, if you guys hadn't shown me the love that I got that day walking in the most despondent morality I can possibly think of, I probably wouldn't be here. But you still love me, and I care about that. So thank you.